We'd like to go too, but we cannot open our cages." As you can imagine, this caused a certain consternation, coming at the last minute. None of us knew much about the mice, except what we had heard Dr. Schultz dictate into his tape recorder. From that we had learned only that they had been getting the same injections we were getting, and that the treatment had worked about as well on them as on us. They were a sort of side experiment, without a control group. Justin was studying the cabinet. "Why not?" he said. "If we can get the doors open." Someone muttered, "They'll slow us down." "No," said the mouse Jonathan, "we will not. Only open our cages when you go, and we'll make our own way. We won't even stay with you, if you prefer." "How many are you?" I asked. "Only 8, and the cabinet doors are easy to open. There's just a simple hook halfway up." But Justin and Arthur had already figured that out. They climbed up the screen, unhooked the hook, and the doors swung open. "The cages open the same way as yours," said another mouse, "but we can't reach far enough to unlatch them." "All right," I said. "Tomorrow night, as soon as Dr. Schultz and the others leave, we'll open your cages, and you can follow the thread with us to get out. After that, you're on your own." "Agreed," said Jonathan. "And thank you." "And now," I said, "we should all get back to the cages. Justin, please hook the doors again." I had latched myself into my cage and was getting ready for sleep when I heard a scratching noise on the door, and there was Jenner, climbing down from above. "Nicodemus," he said, "can I come in?" "Of course, but it's getting on toward morning. I won't stay long." He unlatched the door and entered. "There's something we've got to decide." "I know," I said. "I've been thinking about it, too."
"When we get out, where are we going to go?"
I could not see Jenner's face in the dark of the cage, but I knew from his voice that he was worrying. I said, "At first I thought home, of course. But then when I began remembering, I realized that won't work. We could find the way, I suppose, now that we can read. But if we did, what then? We wouldn't find anyone we know."
"And yet," Jenner said, "you know that's not the real point."
"No.
The real point is this. We don't know where to go because we don't know what we are. Do you want to go back to living in a sewer pipe and eating other people's garbage? Because that's what rats do. But the fact is, we aren't rats anymore. We're something Dr. Schultz has made. Something new. Dr. Schultz says our intelligence has increased more than 1,000%. I suspect he's underestimated. I think we're probably as intelligent as he is, maybe more. We can read, and with a little practice, we'll be able to write, too. I mean, to do both. I think we can learn to do anything we want. But where do we do it? Where does a group of civilized rats fit in?"
"I don't know," I said. "We're going to have to find out. It won't be easy. But even so, the first step must be to get out of here. We're lucky to have a chance, but it won't last. We're a jump ahead of Dr. Schultz. If he knew what we know, he wouldn't leave us alone in here another night. And he's sure to find out soon."
"Another thing to worry about," Jenner said. "If we do get away, when he finds we're gone, won't he figure out how we did it? And won't he realize that we must have learned to read?"
"Probably."
"And then what? What will happen when he announces that there's a group of civilized rats roaming loose? Rats that can read and think and figure things out?"
I said, "Let's wait till we're free before we worry about that." But Jenner was right. It was a thing to worry about. And maybe it still is. The next day was terrible. I kept expecting to hear Dr. Schultz say, "Who took my screwdriver?" And then to hear Julie add, "My thread is missing, too." That could have happened and set them to thinking. But it didn't. And that night, an hour after Julie, George, and Dr. Schultz left the laboratory, we were out of our cages and gathered, the whole group of us, before the mouse cabinet. Justin opened its doors, unlatched their cages, and the mice came out. They looked very small and frightened, but one strode bravely forward.
"You are Nicodemus," he said to me.
"I'm Jonathan. Thank you for taking us out with you." "We're not out yet," I said, "but you're welcome." We had no time for chatting. The light coming in the windows was turning gray. In less than an hour it would be dark, and we would need light to figure out how to open the screen at the end of the shaft. We went to the opening in the baseboard. "Justin," I said, "take the lead. Roll up the thread as you go. I'll bring up in the rear. No noise. There's sure to be somebody awake somewhere in the building. We don't want them to hear us." I didn't want to leave the thread where it might be found. The more I thought about it, the more I felt sure Dr. Schultz would try to track us down, for quite a few reasons. Justin lifted the grid, pushed open the sliding panel, and one by one we went through. As I watched the others go ahead of me, I noticed for the first time that one of the mice was white. Then I went in myself, closing the grid behind me and pushing the panel half shut again, its normal position. With Justin leading the way, we moved through the dark passage quickly and easily. In only 15 or 20 minutes we had reached the end of the thread. Then, as Justin had told us it would, the shaft widened. We could hear the whir of the machine ahead, and almost immediately we saw a square of grey daylight. We had reached the end of the shaft. And there a terrible thing happened. Justin, you will recall, had told us that the machine, the pump that pulled air through the shaft, had switched from low speed to high when he had first explored through there. So we were forewarned. The trouble was, the forewarning was no use at all, not so far as the mice were concerned. We were approaching the lighted square of the opening when the roar began. The blast of air came like a sudden whistling gale. It took my breath and flattened my ears against my head, and I closed my eyes instinctively. I was still in the rear, and when I opened my eyes again, I saw one of the mice sliding past me, clawing uselessly with his small nails at the smooth metal beneath him. Another followed him, and still another, as one by one they were blown backward into the dark maze of tunnels we had just left. I braced myself in the corner of the shaft and grabbed at one as he slid by. It was the white mouse. I caught him by one leg, pulled him around behind me, and held on. Another blew face on into the rat ahead of me and stopped there. It was Jonathan, who had been near the lead. But the rest were lost, 6 in all. They were simply too light. They blew away like dead leaves, and we never saw them again. In another minute the roar stopped, the rush of air slowed from a gale to a breeze, and we were able to go forward again. I said to the white mouse, "You better hold on to me. That might happen again." He looked at me in dismay. "But what about the others? 6 are lost. I've got to go back and look for them." Jonathan quickly joined him. "I'll go with you." "No," I said. "That would be useless and foolish. You have no idea which shaft they were blown into, nor even if they all went the same way. And if you should find them, how would you find your way out again? And suppose the wind comes again? Then there would be 8 lost instead of 6. The wind did come again, 6 times more, while we worked with the screwdriver to pry open the screen. Each time we had to stop work and hang on, the 2 mice clung to the screen itself. Some of us braced ourselves behind them in case they should slip. And Justin, taking the thread with him as a guideline, went back to search for the other 6. He explored shaft after shaft to the end of the spool, calling softly as he went, but it was futile. To this day, we don't know what became of those 6 mice. They may have found their way out eventually, or they may have died in there. We left an opening in the screen for them, just in case. The screen,
It was heavy wire, with holes about the size of an acorn, and it was set in a steel frame. We pried and hammered at it with a screwdriver, but we could not move it. It was fastened on the outside. We couldn't see how. Finally, the white mouse had an idea. "Push the screwdriver through the wire near the bottom," he said, "and pry up." We did, and the wire bent a fraction of an inch. We did it again, prying down, then left, then right. The hole in the wire grew slowly bigger, until the white mouse said, "I think that's enough." He climbed to the small opening, and by squirming and twisting he got through. Jonathan followed him. They both fell out of sight. But in a minute Jonathan's head came back in view on the outside. "It's a sliding bolt," he said. "We're working on it." Inside we could hear the faint rasping as the two mice tugged on the bolt handle, working it back. Then the crack at the base of the screen widened. We pushed it open, and we were standing on the roof of Nim, free. The Boniface Estate. Mrs. Frisby said, "Jonathan and Mr. Ages got the screen open." "Yes," Nicodemus said. "And without them, I doubt that we could have done it. The steel frame was strong, the bolt was secure, and the wire so stiff we could not have bent it enough for one of us to go through. So we were glad they were with us, and asked them if they would, after all, like to stay with us. Since there were only two of them, they said they would, for the time being at least." And now began a journey that was to last, with some interruptions, for almost 2 years. Parts of it were pleasant. It was a joyful feeling at first, just to be free again, and to get those laboratory collars off. And parts of it were terrible. I have made notes about all of it, and if the time ever comes when rats publish books of their own, I intend to write a book about it. It would be a long book, full of trouble and danger, too much to tell now. It was in one of the dangerous times that I lost my eye and got the scar you see on my face. But we did have some happy times, and some pieces of great good luck, two in particular, that helped to explain how we got here and what our plans are now. It was early summer when we got out. We had known that beforehand. We could tell by the lateness of the light through the windows, though it was dark when we finally stood on the roof. We had no trouble getting down the side of the building, however. There were downspouts in the corners with plenty of toeholds. We dropped the screwdriver and the spool of thread into one of these. A little lower there was ivy. We were all good climbers, and there was moonlight to see by. In less than 15 minutes we were on the ground. Staying in the darkest shadows, under the bushes when we could, we sped away from Nim, not knowing or caring at first what direction we were going. Nobody saw us. During the next few weeks we lived as we could. We had, in a way, to learn all over again how to get along. For although the world outside the laboratory was the same, we ourselves were different. We were a couple of times reduced to eating from dumps and garbage cans. But knowing how to read, we quickly learned to recognize signs on buildings. Groceries, supermarket, meats and vegetables, for instance, let us know that there was food inside for the taking. And once inside a supermarket at night, they always leave a few lights on, we could even read the signs on the wall directing us to Section 8 for dairy products, cheese, Section 3 for baked goods, and so on. In the country there were barns and silos stocked with grain and corn, and chicken houses full of eggs. Occasionally we came upon other rats, and a few times we talked with them, but not for long, because after just a few words they would begin to look at us strangely and edge away. Somehow they could tell that we were different. I think we even looked different. Either the diet or the injections at Nim had made us bigger and stronger than other rats,
and all the strange rats we saw looked to us surprisingly weak and puny. So we were set apart from even our own kind. It was while we were in the country that we had our first important stroke of luck. We had just about decided, after nearly 4 months of freedom and constant roving, to find a place to settle down, if not permanently, at least for the winter. We thought that it should be in the country, but not too far from a town, so that we would have access to grocery stores as well as barns and gardens. It was about this time, too, that I began to wonder, and worry somewhat, about the fact that whatever we ate, whatever we needed, must always be stolen. Rats had always lived that way. And yet, why? I talked to some of the others about this. It was the beginning of a discontent, and an idea that kept growing, although slowly. The season was autumn. We were walking one evening down a winding country road. We never walked really on the road, but along the edge, so that we could vanish into the bushes or a ditch if anyone came along. You can imagine the 20 rats and 2 mice traveling in procession would cause some comment, and we did not want that. As we walked, we reached a very high fence of wrought iron, the kind that looks like a row of black iron spears fastened together with pointed tops, an expensive fence, surrounding a large estate with a big, expensive-looking house in the middle and well-kept grounds and gardens. We walked along past this fence until we reached a gate. "There's nobody living in there," said Justin. "How do you know?" "The gate's padlocked. And look, dead weeds standing outside of it, not even bent. Nobody's driven in here for a while." The house had a quiet, deserted look. There was a mailbox in front, hanging open, empty. "I wonder if we could get in," Jenner said. "Why should we? It's a big place. It would have a big pantry, big cupboard, big freezer. If it's as empty as it looks..." We turned into the grounds, moving cautiously, and from beneath some bushes we watched the windows. As dusk fell, lights came on in several of them, both upstairs and down. Jenner said, "That's supposed to make us think there's someone there." "Yes," said Justin, "but there isn't. I could see one of the lamps when it came on. There was nobody near it, and they all came on at the same time." "Automatic switches to keep burglars away." "Well, they're not keeping me away," said Justin. He ran to the house, climbed to one of the window sills, and looked in. He tried another. Then he came back. "Nobody," he said. So we went in. We found a small window in the back with a cracked pane, knocked out one corner of the glass, and climbed through. At first we planned just to look for food. We found it, too, enough to last us for a year or more. As Jenner had predicted, there was a big freezer, well-stocked, bread, meat, vegetables, everything, and a whole room full of shelves covered with canned food. The cans baffled us at first, as they had in the grocery stores. We could read what was in them, but we couldn't get it out. Then Arthur found a machine on the kitchen counter. He read the instructions on the side of it. "Slide can under cutter and press switch." We tried it. The can turned slowly around in the machine, and when we pulled it out, the top had been cut free. I'll always remember what was in that first can. Clam chowder. Delicious. After we had eaten, we wandered around the house. It was a rich man's mansion, with beautiful furniture and fine rugs and carpeting on the floor. There was a crystal chandelier in the dining room, and a big stone fireplace in the living room. But the greatest treasure of all, for us, was in the study. This was a large, rectangular room, with walnut panelling, a walnut desk, leather chairs, and walls lined to the ceiling with books. Thousands of books about every subject you could think of. There were shelves of paperbacks, There were encyclopedias, histories, novels, philosophies, and textbooks of physics, chemistry, electrical engineering, and others, more than I can name. Luckily, there was even one of those small ladders on wheels they use in some libraries to get to the top shelves. Well, we fell on those books with even more appetite than on the food. And in the end, we moved into the house and stayed all winter. We could do that, it turned out, without much fear of discovery. We learned that from some newspaper cuttings I found on the desk in the study. They were about a wedding, and most of them showed pictures of a newly married couple leaving a house to begin their honeymoon. The groom was a Mr. Gordon Boniface, heir to the Gould Stetson fortune, and the house they were leaving was the house we were in. According to the clippings, they were going on a trip all the way around the world. They were coming back to the Boniface estate in May. Until then, it was our estate. Oh, there was a caretaker gardener who came 3 times a week, and once in a while he would check the house in a cursory sort of way. That is, he would unlock the front door, glance around to see that everything looked all right, and then lock it and leave. But he didn't live there. He lived in a small house down the road. And we were expecting him when he came. We had figured out, from the way the place was kept up, the lawns mowed, leaves raked, gardens weeded and watered, that there had to be somebody working on it. So we posted a watch, saw him coming, and kept watching him all the time he was there. And we made sure, when he looked in the house, that everything did look all right. This involved a certain amount of work. We had to haul all our empty tin cans and other trash at night out into a hidden place in the woods, quite far from the house. We cleaned up after ourselves, carefully. We learned to use the water taps and the dusting cloths we found in the kitchen closet. If the caretaker had looked more closely, in fact, he would have seen that the kitchen counters were somewhat shinier than they should have been in an empty house. But he didn't. He never even noticed the small corner of glass missing from the back window. And all winter, far into the night, we read books and we practiced writing. The Main Hall. There came a knock on Nicodemus's office door. It opened, and Justin and Mr. Ages entered. "Back so soon?" said Nicodemus. "Soon," said Justin. "It's past noon. It's lunchtime." "Past noon!" Mrs. Frisby stood up, remembering her children waiting at home. Down in the rat's home, in the artificial light, it was hard to tell the passage of time, and she had been so engrossed in Nicodemus's story that she had not glanced at the clock. Justin was wearing a satchel like Nicodemus's, and from it he took a small paper package. "Here's Dragon's Medicine," he said, putting it on the table. He asked Mrs. Frisby, "Did he tell you about the toy tinker?" Nicodemus said, "No, I was just coming to that." "But I can't stay to hear it now," said Mrs. Frisby. "My children will be waiting for their lunch." A plan was worked out. Mrs. Frisby would go home to take care of her children. Nicodemus, Justin, Arthur and the other rats involved would work out the details of moving her house, which would be done that night at about 11 o'clock. "After the Fitzgibbons are asleep, and we're sure Dragon is too," said Nicodemus. Mrs. Frisby would return in mid-afternoon to the rosebush. Mr. Ages said, "And I'm going to lie down. After making that trip with this cast, I'm tired." "You can have your choice of rooms," said Nicodemus. "Now that Jenner and his friends are gone, we have 7 empty." "Thank you," said Mr. Ages. "Mrs. Frisby, when you return, I'll tell you as well as I can exactly how to put the powder in Dragon's food." As she hurried home, Mrs. Frisby considered just how much she should tell her children about all that had happened, and all that was going to happen. She decided at that stage, at least, she would not tell them about their father's connection with the rats. Also that she would not say she had volunteered to put the sleeping powder into Dragon's bowl. That would worry them. She could tell them perhaps when it was safely done, when, among other things, there would be no chance for Martin to volunteer in her place. She would tell them simply that, as the owl had suggested, she had gone to the rats and asked for help. She had found them friendly and intelligent, and a group of them were coming that night to move the house to a place where it would be safe from the plough. That would be enough. She could tell them the whole story later, when she knew it all herself. But it was not enough. The children were skeptical at first, then intensely curious, especially Timothy, who was looking stronger and feeling more energetic, but still staying in bed, primarily because Teresa and Martin had made him. "But why should the rats do that?" said Timothy. "We don't know them at all. Nobody does. They keep to themselves." "Maybe it's because the owl sent me," said Mrs. Frisby, searching for an answer that would satisfy him. "They seem to be impressed by the owl." "For that matter," said Timothy, "I don't even see why the owl wanted to help. He's no friend of ours either." "Maybe they thought some day we could do them a favor in return."
"Oh, Mother," said Cynthia, "how could we ever do them a favor?"
"You forget. I did do Jeremy a favor. That's what started the whole thing." "That and my getting sick," said Timothy.
"I wish I could get up. I'm tired of bed."
"Not yet," said Mrs. Frisby, glad to change the subject. "You must save your strength, because tonight you will have to get up for a little while when they move the house. We must be sure you're well wrapped up and hope that the night is warm."
"It will be," said Martin. "It turned quite hot outside."
They ate lunch. That afternoon Mrs. Frisby told the children that she must leave them to confer again with the rats about moving the house. When she thought of the danger she would face in just a few more hours, she wanted to kiss them all goodbye. But knowing that Timothy, at least, was already suspicious, she did not dare, but told them only that they should not worry if she was a little late getting home for supper. On her way back to the rosebush, she felt quite relieved, almost cheerful. Her problem was nearly solved, and the final solution was in sight. If all went well, Timothy would be saved. If all went well. Then the thought of what she had to do came back to her like the clanging of an alarm bell. What worried her most was not so much putting the powder into Dragon's bowl, but the fear that at the last minute she might lose her nerve and bungle it somehow. That could wreck the plan. She looked toward the Fitzgibbons' farmhouse, and there on the back porch, lying in the sun, was Dragon. He was watching a pair of sparrows playing in the grass halfway to the chicken yard. The tip of his tail barely twitched as he debated whether or not they were near enough to spring for. He looked very big and very dangerous. At least he was not looking in her direction, and Mrs. Frisby hurried on to the bush, directly to the hidden entrance, and slipped inside. When she reached the arched portal, Brutus was standing guard as before, but this time he greeted her politely.
"I've been expecting you," he said.
"May I go in?"
"If you'll wait just a minute, I'll get Justin."
He went inside the arch and pressed a small button on the wall. Mrs. Frisby had not noticed it before. "A doorbell," she said.
"It rings a buzzer down below. If I pushed it 3 times, you'd see some action."
"Action? That's the alarm signal. 12 rats would come out this door, ready to fight. All the rest, with the women and children, would be hurrying out the back door." "I didn't know there was a back door."
"It comes out in the woods, in a blackberry bramble. It's got a longer tunnel than this one."
When Justin appeared,
They went down the same hallway as before, but this time, when they reached the chamber where the elevator and the stairway led down, Justin paused.
"Nicodemus thought you might like to see our main hall. Just a quick look. He said you asked about the plan."
"I did," said Mrs. Frisby, "but he didn't tell me about it."
"It's more than just a plan now, but we're used to calling it that. If you see the main hall, you'll get an idea of what we're doing."
So instead of going down as they had before, Justin led the way across the chamber, where, as Mrs. Frisby had noticed, the tunnel continued. They walked along for what seemed like several more minutes.
"Somewhere right along here," Justin remarked, "we're entering the woods. You'll notice the tunnel runs a bit crooked. We had to bend it to go around tap roots, some as thick as fence posts."
They went on until they came to a fork in the tunnel.
"Right fork leads out to the blackberry bramble," said Justin. "Left fork leads to the main hall."
They took the left fork.
"Now brace yourself for a surprise."
From ahead came noises, the sound of many rats talking, a sound of hurrying and thumping and of machinery running. They stepped into a room as full of activity as a factory. It was the biggest room Mrs. Frisby had ever seen, half the size of a house, with a ceiling and floor of hard grey rock. It was brightly lit with electric bulbs, here the large-sized ones, strung unshaded, and beneath them were rats at work everywhere. Rats running electric motors that ran belts that ran small circular saws, lathes, drills, grindstones, and other tools Mrs. Frisby could not name. Rats hammering, welding, cutting. But most of all, rats hauling. There was a steady procession to and from the far end of the chamber, and each of these rats wore a harness, to which was fastened a pair of large, sturdy sacks, one on each side, like a miniature pack horse. As the rats trooped in, their sacks were empty. They disappeared into a part of the room that was hidden by a high wall of wood. When they came out, the sacks were full and heavy. As she watched, a troop of 10, their sacks bulging, went past her out the tunnel. They greeted Justin and nodded at her, but they did not pause. She noticed that just inside the entrance, an electric fan whirred quietly, aiming inward, pulling fresh air into the room from somewhere out in the woods. Mrs. Frisby stood beside Justin and gaped. She felt dizzy at the sight, the motion, the noise, and the size of the room, which must have measured 20 feet long and almost as wide.
"How could you ever dig out such a big room?" she asked.
"We didn't," said Justin. "We found it. It's a natural cave. You can see that the ceiling and floor are solid rock. That's the reason, or the main one, we chose this spot to live. Others had lived here before us. Probably for centuries before there was a farmhouse, bears, then wolves, then foxes, then groundhogs. We had quite a cleaning job to do, I can tell you. When we found it, there was a large hole, only a few feet long, leading straight in, but it was so full of sticks and leaves you could hardly see it. We closed that entrance entirely and dug another, longer and narrower, our back door. Then we dug our living quarters under the rose bush, and the entrance you came in. But the cave is still our chief workshop. Let's go in." As they entered, some of the rats looked up. Some waved and smiled, but all quickly turned back to the work they were doing, as if they were in a hurry.
"They're all on a schedule," Justin explained, talking close to Mrs. Frisby's ear to be heard above the noise, "so they can't stop working."
One group, especially busy, was gathered around an odd-shaped object of wood and metal about a foot long. It was curved and had a point at one end. It looked, Mrs. Frisby thought, rather like the side of a small boat. Could the rats be making a boat? Then she saw that they were fastening a strong metal ring to the top of it. Justin led her to it.
That, he said, is our most important invention, the key to the whole plan. We made a pilot model last fall. We tried it out and it worked, so now we're making three more.
But what is it?
It's a plow. Nicodemus designed it himself after reading every book he could find about farm tools. It's light and sharp, especially made to be pulled by rats. It takes 8 of us to pull it, more if the turf is tough. But with it we can turn over in a day of hard work a patch of earth about 10 by 15 feet.
But why? What do you need it for?
Come over here and I'll show you. He led the way to the back of the cave, where the high walls stood. He opened a door and beckoned her through. She stood in a large wooden bin, starting at her feet and rising in a slope to the wall of the cave, was a small mountain of grain.
Oats, said Justin.
He led her on, opened another door on another mountain.
Wheat,
he said, and others. Barley, corn, soybeans. We've been building these stockpiles for a long time, he said. All from Mr. Fitzgibbon's barn. We now have a 2-year supply for 108 rats, plus enough to plant for 2 crops, in case the first one fails. In there, he gestured toward the last bin in the row, we have boxes full of seeds. Seeds for tomatoes, beets, carrots, melons, and a lot more. All the time they stood there, the steady procession of rats continued. They entered the bins, took off their harness sacks, filled the sacks with grain, put them on again, and left through the tunnel, out the back door. They looked, Mrs. Frisbee thought, like very large ants, endlessly toiling on an anthill. Justin must have got the same impression, for he said, "If the ants can do it, Nicodemus says, if the bees can do it, so can we."
"Do what?"
"Why, live without stealing, of course. That's the whole idea. That's the plan." The Toy Tinker.
"We left the Boniface estate on the 1st of May," said Nicodemus. "We knew a lot more than when we went in. We had been there 8 months.
"Then," said Justin, "we found the toy tinker."
They were back in Nicodemus's office. Mr. Ages, having rested, sat with them.
"Not quite yet," said Mr. Ages.
"No," said Nicodemus.
"That was in late summer. When we first got out, we began searching for a place to live permanently, or at least a place where we could stay as long as we wanted. We had a pretty clear idea of what we were looking for. We had had plenty of time to talk about it, on the long winter evenings in the library, between reading books."
"The reading we did! We knew very little about the world, you see, and we were curious. We learned about astronomy, about electricity, biology and mathematics, about music and art. I even read quite a few books of poetry, and got to like it pretty well. But what I liked best was history. I read about the ancient Egyptians, the Greeks and Romans, and the Dark Ages, when the old civilizations fell apart, and the only people who could read and write were the monks. They lived apart in monasteries. They led the simplest kind of lives, and studied and wrote. They grew their own food, built their own houses and furniture. They even made their own tools and their own paper. Reading about that, I began getting some ideas of how we might live. Most of the books were about people. We tried to find some about rats, but there wasn't much. We did find a few things. There were 2 sets of encyclopedias that had sections on rats. From them we learned that we were about the most hated animals on earth, except maybe snakes and germs. That seemed strange to us, and unjust, especially when we learned that some of our close cousins, squirrels, for instance, and rabbits, were well liked. But people think we spread diseases, and I suppose possibly we do, though never intentionally,
and surely we never spread as many diseases as people themselves do. Still, it seemed to us that the main reason we were hated must be that we always lived by stealing. From the earliest times, rats lived around the edges of human cities and farms, stowed away on men's ships, gnawed holes in their floors, and stole their food. Sometimes we were accused of biting human children. I didn't believe that, nor did any of us, unless it was some kind of a subnormal rat, bred in the worst of city slums. And that, of course, can happen to people, too. Had we, then, no use at all in the world? One encyclopedia had a sentence of praise for us. The common rat is highly valued as an experimental animal in medical research due to his toughness, intelligence, versatility, and biological similarity to man. We knew quite a bit about that already. But there was one book, written by a famous scientist, that had a chapter about rats. Millions of years ago, he said, rats seemed to be ahead of all the other animals, seemed to be making a civilization of their own. They were well organized and built quite complicated villages in the fields. Their descendants today are the rats known as prairie dogs. But somehow that didn't work out. The scientists thought maybe it was because the rats' lives were too easy, while the other animals, especially the monkeys, were living in the woods and getting tougher and smarter. The prairie dogs grew soft and lazy and made no more progress. Eventually the monkeys came out of the woods, walking on their hind legs, and took over the prairies and almost everything else. It was then that the rats were driven to become scavengers and thieves, living on the fringes of a world run by men. Still, it was interesting to us that for a while, at least, the rats had been ahead. We wondered, if they had stayed ahead, if they had gone on and developed a real civilization, what would it have been like? Would rats, too, have shed their tails and learned to walk erect? Would they have made tools? Probably, though we thought not so soon and not so many. A rat has a natural set of tools that monkeys lack, sharp, pointed teeth that never stop growing. Consider what the beavers can build with no tools but their rodent teeth. Surely rats would have developed reading and writing, judging by the way we took to it. But what about machines? What about cars and airplanes? Maybe not airplanes, after all. Monkeys living in trees must have felt a need to fly, must have envied the birds around them. Rats may not have that instinct. In the same way, a rat civilization would probably never have built skyscrapers, since rats prefer to live underground. But think of the endless subways below subways below subways they would have had. We thought and talked quite a bit about all this, and we realized that a rat civilization, if one ever did grow up, would not necessarily turn out to be anything at all like human civilization. The fact was, after 8 months in the Boniface estate, none of us were sorry to move out of it. It had given us shelter, free food, and an education, but we were never really comfortable there. Everything in it was designed for animals who looked, moved, and thought differently from the way we did. Also, it was above ground, and that never felt quite natural to us. So when we left, we decided that our new home should be underground, preferably, if we could find it, a cave. But where? We thought hard and studied maps and atlases. There were plenty of those in the study. Finally, we reached some conclusions. To find a cave, we would have to go where there were mountains. There aren't many caves in flatlands. And for food, it would have to be near a town, or better, a farm. So we wanted to find a farm, preferably a big one, with a big barn and silos full of grain, near the mountains. We studied the map some more, and it was Jenner, I think, who spotted this area as a good place to look. On the map, a big part of it was covered with the contour lines that show mountains, and across these were written the words, Thorn Mountains National Forest. Beneath that, in smaller letters, it said, Protected Wilderness Preserve. Bordering this, where the mountains turned to foothills, the map showed rolling country with quite a few roads, but hardly any towns, which we thought ought to mean farmland. We were right, as of course you know now. It took us 2 months of steady travelling to get to the Thorn Mountain National Forest, but we found it. We're under the edge of it right now. And there are plenty of caves, most of them never visited by people, because people aren't allowed to drive into a wilderness preserve. There aren't any roads in the forest, but only a few jeep trails used by rangers, and airplanes are not permitted to fly over it. We looked at a lot of caves, some big, some small, some dry, but mostly damp. Before we chose this cave and this farm, however, we found the toy tinker. It began as a sad sort of thing. We found an old man lying in the woods one morning, near one of the jeep trails, not so far from here, and he was dead. We don't know what he died of. We guessed it must have been a heart attack. He was dressed in a black suit, old-fashioned in style, but neat, not ragged. His hair was white, and his face looked gentle. I wonder who he was and where he was going, Justin said. Whoever he was, Jenner said, he wasn't supposed to be in here at all. We ought to bury him, I said. So we did, not by digging a grave, but by covering him with a high mound of leaves and stones and twigs and earth. It was in gathering material for this mound that Justin made the second discovery. He was back in the bushes, out of our sight. Look here, he called. I found a truck. It was a very ancient truck, with a small round hood, but it had been lovingly polished and was wonderfully shiny. The body, which was square and large, had been rebuilt and painted red and gold. It had little windows with white curtains, and between them, lettered in gold, were signs. The Toy Tinker. Toys, repairs, hobby kits, model sets, electrical toys, all work guaranteed. Obviously the truck had belonged to the old man. He was a peddler and mender of toys. The red and gold wagon was his shop and his home, and he had driven into the woods to camp for the night. It was against the law, of course, so he had concealed the truck behind some bushes, off the trail, under a big beech tree. We could see where he had made a campfire, carefully surrounding it with stones and clearing away the brush, so he would not set the woods afire. Beyond the beech tree, a narrow brook flowed. It was a peaceful spot. We could see what had probably caused the old man's death. One wheel of the truck had sunk into the soft earth and was stuck. A shovel lay near it. He had been trying to dig it out. The work had been too hard for him, and he had started to go for help when he collapsed. This much we could figure out just by looking. Then somebody said, "Whose truck is it now?" "It belongs to his heirs," I said. "Whoever they are," said Jenner, "he may not even have any. He seems to have been alone." "Anyway," said someone else, "how would they ever find it?" "That's true," I said. "We don't know who he was, and if we did, we have no way of notifying anyone. So, I suppose, if we want it, the truck is ours." "Why don't we see what's in it?" Thorn Valley. "It might almost be easier to tell what wasn't in it," Nicodemus continued. "That truck was as roomy as a small bus, and the old man hadn't wasted a square foot of it. Not that it was cluttered. On the contrary, everything was neatly in place on its shelf or hook or in its cabinet. It took us a while to understand what a treasure we had found. The truck contained, as you might expect, a big stock of toys. It also contained the old man's simple living quarters, a cot, a lamp, a work table, a folding chair, a bucket for carrying water, a plate, pots, pans, and so on. There was a tiny refrigerator with food in it, and some canned stuff, peas, beans, peaches, things like that. Most of the toys, we thought at first, we had no particular use for. There were toy automobiles and trucks, windmills and merry-go-rounds, airplanes, boats and a lot of others, mostly run on batteries. It was entertaining to look at them, and some of them we even tried out. For a while, the floor looked like Christmas morning. We tired of that and explored farther into the truck. Up near the front, we found several large cardboard boxes, and when we opened them, we found that they were full of electric motors of assorted sizes, replacement engines for broken or worn-out toys. There were dozens of them, ranging from very small, no bigger than a spool of thread, up to some so heavy we could hardly move them. Then, next to these, we found the real treasure, the old man's tools. They were neatly arranged in shining rows inside a steel cabinet as big as a trunk. There were screwdrivers, saws, hammers, clamps, vices, wrenches, pliers. There were welding tools, soldering irons, and electric drills. And the beauty of it was, since they were designed for working on toys, they were nearly all miniature, easily small enough for us to handle. Yet they were themselves not toys. They were made of the finest tempered steel, like the tools of a watchmaker or a dentist. It was Arthur who said it first. "Do you realize what we've got here? We could open our own machine shop. With these tools and all these motors, we could make anything we wanted." "We could," said Jenner, "except you've forgotten one thing." "What's that?" "We have no electricity. The old man couldn't have run these tools off batteries. The small toy motors, yes, but not the real ones, not the power tools. He had to plug into house current to use those. See, there's his extension cord on the wall." There was a long coil of heavy black cable hanging from a hook on the wall. It had a plug on one end and a socket on the other. Now another rat spoke up, a rat named Sullivan. He was a great friend of Arthur's, and like him, had a particular interest in engines and electricity. "Maybe," he said, "we could plug into a house current, too." "How?" I said. "Who'd let us?" "Do you remember that cave we looked at the other day? The one we decided was too close to the farmhouse?" That was the beginning of it. The end you have seen yourself. He was speaking of the cave you saw today. We all trooped back to it and examined it more carefully. It was too close, or at least closer than we had planned to live to a human habitation. But then we saw the huge rose bush near the tractor shed, where, with quite a lot of digging, we could put a concealed entrance. But most important, we noticed that there was an electric light in the tractor shed. Mr. Fitzgibbon had an underground power cable leading out from his house to the shed. We dug a tunnel to it, tapped it, and we had all the electricity we needed. Near it ran a water pipe. We tapped that, too, and we had running